Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out the events page. We got events coming up in 2021. We got one in Bentonville, Arkansas, April 16th and 17th. We want you to come check that thing out. And then also the General Conference out there in San Diego, hopefully, in October. So you can register for both those events right now and just go to the events page. You'll see them both there. Register for one or both of those events. Chad, Christmas has gone by the time this releases, but not by the time we're recording it. Christmas has not yet arrived, but we just want to say, because it will have come and gone, at least the day of Christmas, not the season. I mean, I don't want to get other... I mean, you know how some of these people are, Chad? I mean...
There are 12 days in Christmas
Day. And they don't start until Christmas.
Right.
Don't get it wrong. And technically, it's not Christmas. We're in Advent when we're recording this. I mean, so just make sure you keep everything straight. There's some calendar Nazis out there that will correct you. But if they have to understand that we live in this world where we record things and then we release things. And so we have to just say... I hope everyone, including you, Chad, had a very Merry Christmas Day.
Yeah, we're always going back to the future.
That's right.
It's just the way we live in the podcast world.
That's right. That's right. Also, if you didn't check out, since you will be still in the Christmas season, if you didn't check out the Christmas special, which we did drop, that did release, where Chad and I and Eric Sorensen were joined up by the guys from Theocast, and we talked a little bit about the incarnation. Make sure you check that out. Even if it's after Christmas, you know, it's still relevant. The incarnation is one of those things that is kind of always relevant.
Yeah, that was a fun conversation. Those guys are great.
Yeah, it's good times. So anyway, we're back to it. Hope you all had a Merry Christmas. Chad, we are in 1 Samuel chapter 21.
Yeah, not a very Christmassy text or Advent text, but it's pretty interesting. We got some New Testament very clear, explicit New Testament connections here. In fact, in three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all bring this particular scenario up. So we left off with that very long chapter, chapter 20, where we have the final break, I guess you could say, like no possible chance of any kind of reconciliation between David and Saul. There's a breakdown between Saul and his son Jonathan as well. They exchange some pretty heated words. Saul lobs some really nasty insults at his son. And then it all finishes up, that chapter all finishes up with David and Jonathan meeting. And Jonathan goes back to the city, back to kind of the abysmal situation that he finds himself with his dad. And then David, we will find out in this next chapter, is on the run. So he's going to first head to a place that's not very far away. It's called Nob or Nov in Hebrew. Says that David came to this place to Ahimelech, the priest. So this is evidently, we're never kind of told this directly, but kind of patching things together from what we know from both 1 Samuel as well as Jeremiah. Evidently what happened was where the tabernacle had been located was destroyed in some of the wars between the Philistines and the Israelites. The tabernacle was then moved to this particular place. Now, just the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant is not there. The Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle that was built to house it have been separated for some time and will continue to be separated for quite a while. So it's kind of a strange period in Israel's history where you have tabernacle one place, Ark of the Covenant someplace else. But anyway, this is the new site of the sanctuary of God. And Ahimelech is the priest. He comes trembling to meet David. Kind of interesting tie in here. That verb for trembling, that Hebrew verb for trembling, is also used back in chapter 16. That is the story of when Samuel went to Bethlehem to anoint David as the replacement king. And it says that when Samuel arrived in the city, the men of the city came out trembling to meet him. Same verb that's used here. So there's some parallels between these two particular situations. Of course, the trembling itself, of course, indicates fear. Now, the people of Bethlehem were afraid because there was this, you know, bad blood between Samuel and Saul, and Samuel, the prophet, showing up was probably not a good omen for them. At least that's what they surmised. Now, when Ahimelech sees David showing up, he probably is thinking the same thing. You know, he's maybe heard about the problems between David and Saul, and now David shows up. He's all alone. He's unarmed. He's Ahimelech, I'm thinking, is probably saying in his head, this doesn't look good because it looks like David is now a refugee from Saul.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like this would be, if say you're a man of the cloth, and here comes this guy that the most powerful guy in your land is after, and you know this, because I am assuming that he knows this, right?
Yeah, I'm sure word got around. Yeah.
And then he shows up at your place. Well, this is a tough situation because you probably are going to feel like you are duty-bound to help this person if they need it, since mm-hmm. you haven't probably heard of any legitimate accusations of crimes or sins or anything. And so, yeah, this is a little bit of a situation you didn't want. You're like, oh, here's this guy. He's all by himself. This guy's going to ask me to help him. And then how is Saul going to feel about that when he finds that out? Probably not great.
Yeah, as we'll find out in the next chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not great at all. Yeah. Yeah. Very bad.
I mean, we will find out that this trembling is sort of warranted.
Yeah. Yeah. He, it was like his emotions knew more than his facts would allow at that point. The trembling was very warranted. We'll discover that once Saul finds out about this exchange between David and Ahimelech. Now, the good thing is, first of all, he asks him a question. So he comes trembling and he says two questions. Number one, why are you alone? And then he kind of repeats it, and no one with you. So why are you alone? Why is no one with you? So that is really what is causing his greatest concern, or that in other words is what he sees that makes him think to himself, uh-oh, this isn't good.
Yeah,
why is David all by himself?
It's the thing that makes him think this guy's on the run, because apparently David's not the kind of guy that is by himself that much. I mean, he is, after all, the commander of armies, and so it's probably rare for him to show up somewhere far away from where he should be. This is not a place that he probably frequents mm-hmm. all by himself. So this has the look of someone on the run.
Right. Yeah. So the good thing is, you know, David is quick on his feet. He's a smart guy. It's very obvious. And he's also, as it were, looking out for Ahimelech, because he gives him plausible deniability in this particular situation. So he tells him this. He says, well, here's what's happened. The king has commissioned me with this thing, this matter. He said to me, don't let anyone know about this thing that I am, this matter that I'm sending you on and with which I have commissioned you. And then David adds, I've also directed the young man to a certain place. In other words, I look like I'm alone, but there's other guys with me. I've just, you know, they're in such and such a place. So I'm going to meet up with them later. So in other words, the reason I'm here by myself is because I sent the other guys, I'm meeting up with them elsewhere. And secondly, I have this urgent matter that the king has sent me on, and I have to attend to it. And I can't tell you anything about it. So the good thing is with Ahimelech, he's like, whether he fully believes this or not, he does have plausible deniability. You know, if something happens, he can always say, well, all I know is what David told me. So I assume that I had no reason to not believe that what he said was true. And then David says, what do you have on hand? What kind of food do you have on hand? He said, give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found. So I'm on this urgent mission, and I need some provisions to take with me.
Now, this is why right here is where I think that I don't think he believes David, but he's happy to not push it any further so that he has this deniable plausibility. Because if someone's like, I'm on this top secret mission from the president, do you have any food? This is a little bit of a giveaway that, like, okay, that's weird, man, that you would be like, yeah, totally meeting up with these other guys. Can't tell you about this matter at hand, but I'm meeting up with him. Also, do you have any canned goods or anything lying around? It's a little bit of a giveaway that, like, really? Like, so you're on this top secret mission and you have zero preparations? Like, the king didn't, like, send you with, like, bread? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, not David's best acting. It'll get better the next part of the chapter.
Well, it's, I mean, it is what it is. I think David is fairly dependent on, like, hey, I'm going to give you this out.
Yeah.
And you could just like take it. Just take the out, man. Just take, just, yeah. Just believe, just choose to believe me. And that way, yeah. if you don't ask any more questions, you could just be like, well, I don't know. This is what he told me.
Mm-hmm. Just trying to help out your servant, David.
Yeah, that's it.
Now this is also kind of strange too. Okay, so we're at the sanctuary. I'm assuming that the priests, at least some of the priests, actually live at this place, right? I mean, there's people there all the time. So if you live in some place, you know, I got a kitchen right behind me. It's full of food because I live. It's my house. So, but the priest doesn't say, sure, you know, come over to my tent or come to my house. We'll get you what you need. He makes it sound like the only thing they have, the only food that they have, is the bread of the presence.
Yeah, it's like if someone showed, it's like someone, you go to your pastor's house and you're like, you got any food? I'm on a mission. He's like, all I've got is like communion bread and wine. That's all I've got. And you're like, what? That's weird, that's, man.
Yeah, that's all you have. Do you eat out all the time or what? Yeah, but that's what he says. He's like, no, the priest tells David, well, I don't have any like ordinary bread here, but I do have the consecrated bread. I've got the holy bread. If only the young men have kept themselves from women. So we know from Deuteronomy, we know from Exodus, we know from Leviticus, a lot of different texts, that when you have a military camp, when you have God's military camp, that there are certain kind of requirements with regard to cleanliness, ritual cleanliness, and one of those to refrain from sexual intercourse. So this, not only in that military camp, but in other instances as well, when people are to prepare themselves for a holy occasion, one of the things they do is they refrain from sex. So the priest is not just kind of making this up. He's like, yeah, I mean, we've got the bread of the presence. We have this holy bread, actually most holy bread, because it's a rank above in sanctity. We have that. And the implication is I can give this to you, but your men that you've told me are waiting for you, they have to have kept themselves from women. So they have to be, in other words, ritually pure.
Now, listen, if you have an imaginary friend, this imaginary friend can be as sanctified as you want him to be. And this is a benefit to David. Because David will be able to say, oh, these young men that are with me, oh, yeah, they've definitely not been with any women, you know, because they don't exist. But... But true enough, oh, that definitely, there's no one, you know, this is one of those things where you can say, oh, there's no one with me that has been fooling around with any women. True enough.
Yep, yep. And not lie one bit. Yeah. Yeah, so David is a little over the top when he answers. He's like, oh, yes. I mean, they, women have been kept from us this time, just as previously, you know, when I set out. The vessels of the young men were holy, and that was like in the past, that was just an ordinary journey. But today, then yes, they are very holy. Everything is sacred about us. You need not worry one bit about any ritual uncleanness being found among the men who are waiting for me. So, I mean, it's, I guess, you know, on the surface, that's true. So the priest agrees. The priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. So if you don't remember, just a quick reviews inside the holy place of the tabernacle and then later inside the holy place of the temple. On the right-hand side, when you entered, was the table of the bread of the presence. And what they would do is they would take 12 loaves of unleavened bread and put those on the table. And then since they were in the presence of the Lord, literally in the face of the Lord, because he was right in the next room, in the Holy of Holies. It was called the bread of, literally the bread of the face, the bread of the presence, it's usually translated. The old King James had showbread. Bread of the presence, bread of the face, and it was considered not just holy, but it was considered most holy. And things that were most holy would communicate holiness. So there were, of course, levels of sanctity in the tabernacle. And most holy was the holiest something could be. And because the bread was most holy, when the priest would consume it every Sabbath and then replace it with 12 more loaves, this bread of God's presence communicated sanctity or holiness to the priest. So it was, it wasn't just holy in and of itself, it was most holy, meaning it conveyed holiness to those who consumed it. Which, anyway, all that's talked about back in Exodus. So that's what is kind of in the background here when he talks about taking the loaves out, putting more loaves in. So I'm assuming that what happened here was they had the loaves of bread on the table. Maybe it was a Sabbath, maybe it was the time to change them out. So they took those out. Ordinarily, that bread would be consumed by the priest. In this case, it's given to David, for David to consume and for his friends. And then it was replaced by 12 more. Now, we'll kind of wrap up this, and we need to talk about the New Testament connection there. Now, verse 7 seems like one of the servants of Saul was there that day.
There's sort of this comment thrown in there that I think immediately you know probably why this is thrown in there. It does seem like a weird spot to throw it in there, but you're like, this seems to be going all right. And then there's verse 7 pops in there and you're like, oh no.
And the fact that he's called a servant of Saul, not a good sign. Anyway, this guy's name is, I always like to think of him as Dog. His name is Doeg, but you know, D-O-E-G, because he really is. He's just like, he's one of the worst, one of the worst characters in scripture. And there are a lot of bad characters in the Bible, but this guy, at least in my personal ranking, is just about top guy, top dog for just being just almost as bad as it gets. And we'll find out why in the next chapter. But his name is Doeg, and he is an Edomite. Now, Edom, you'll remember, is the nation that's named after Esau. So they didn't call them Esauites, they called them Edomites. And there is a long, centuries-long antagonism between Israel and Edom. They're really brothers. I mean, they're related just about as close as two nations can be related. But there's this long antagonism between the Israelites and the Edomites. It begins way back when Israel was trying to move from Egypt to the Promised Land, and the Edomites refused them entry through their land. And then there's antagonism later on in Israel's history, and you finally get the prophets, the minor prophets especially, just lambast Edom. You have psalms that are written against the Edomites. So there is a lot of bad blood between the Israelites and the Edomites. Now, this guy, I'm wondering if he might possibly be one of these kind of foreign mercenaries that's been hired, because that did happen in Israel. And so maybe Saul is employing people like Doeg. He's the chief of Saul's shepherds, it says. So maybe he hired him because he was, yeah, the kind of guy that you hire to oversee other people, and possibly a mercenary on top of it. We find out in the next chapter, he certainly had mercenary tendencies, a willingness to engage in those kind of acts. Anyway, wrap up this section, then we'll go to the New Testament. David says to Ahimelech, is there a spear or a sword on hand? Because I didn't bring my sword and my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent.
Yeah, so I'm on a top, a guy shows up at your house. I'm on a urgent matter from the president. I have no food. And do you have any guns? I mean, come on, man.
Yeah. My credulity here is being stretched to its limits.
Do you have any weapons around here? I mean, I had to leave like really in a hurry.
Yeah, I'm thinking David shows up. He's like out of breath. He's been sweating. He's been running. And then, no wallet, No keys, no phone, no money, no food, no weapons, just the clothes on his back. The priest, he's still playing along with this game. He's like, oh, yeah. You want a gun? Yeah, I got like a I got a 50 caliber in here.
I don't. I've got a cannon in the back.
Yeah, would you like the cannon? Also known as the Sword of Goliath, the Philistine. And then, as if he needs reminding, you know, the guy you killed, the guy you killed in the Valley of Elah, he goes into this long description. It's not just a sword; it's a Sword of Goliath. You know, the Philistine. You know, the guy that you killed in the Valley of Elah. Look, it's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would like to take it for yourself, well, take it, for there is no other accepted here. And it's four words in Hebrew. David's real brief. He's real succinct. He's like, oh, there's none like that. Give it to me. Now, this is odd on so many different levels. What in the world is the Sword of Goliath doing inside the tabernacle, wrapped up behind the ephod? That's some strange stuff there. I don't know when it got there, but it did. Anyway, that's a weapon that he takes.
Yeah, it's very strange. That just, oh yeah, Sword of Goliath just hanging out here. Like that's super weird.
Well, and the fact that this is not going to, I can't see this really doing David much good. I mean, really, to take the cannon example that you gave. Oh yeah, yeah, you need a gun. Oh, we got this cannon. Well, this sword has got to be immense. We remember how large the weaponry of Goliath was. So I can't imagine that his sword was going to be something you could easily use in combat.
No, I mean, yeah, it's literally probably that David saying, hey, you got a, you know, do you got a handgun? He's like, oh, I got this mortar, you know? And you're like, well, I mean, I guess
if that's all you got,
it's going to be kind of a pain to tote around, but I guess I'll take it.
Yeah. So anyway, David shows up with nothing, empty handed. And he leaves with 12 loaves of consecrated bread and the Sword of Goliath. So he is ready to go. Now, this story shows up, as I mentioned earlier, in all three of the synoptics. It's in Matthew 12, it's in Mark 2, and it's in Luke chapter 6. So what happens? I'll let you take it from there, Dan. You know, it's New Testament stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, do you even know this story?
Well, I've heard rumors.
Yeah.
Rumors of it, yeah.
Yeah, no, this happens when Jesus and the disciples are wandering around as they are wont to do, and they're plucking heads of grain and grinding them up in their hands and then eating them.
Hand harvesting, yeah.
Which, by the way, sounds horrible. That's not something that does. You got to be actually pretty hungry to pull this move because
I've chewed on like heads of wheat.
Yeah, man,
it's not a pleasant. No. It's not a pleasant experience.
I realize that you can make bread out of that, but it's not good in its raw form. But Jesus and his disciples, they're doing this, and the Pharisees, well, they think that they've got Jesus dead to rights for breaking the law because they're doing this on the Sabbath, and this is just forbidden. And when they try to peg Jesus for this, saying, "Ah, we got you, sinner," there it is. This is the story that Jesus brings up. He says, oh yeah, well, let me ask you a question. When David went in there and started lying to the priest and then got the bread of the presence, which is not meant for him, he took that. Where's the sin? Was it wrong for him to do it? Now, the priest or the Pharisees, as usual, don't have an answer for this because they're not exactly sure. Because In the Pharisee mind, the letter of the law is really all that matters. What the law is trying to do or accomplish or even say is sort of irrelevant. It's just a matter of, like, have you kept the letter of it? Have you looked at it word for word? And have you not done or done whatever it's telling you not to do or commanding you to do? That's all that matters. What it's actually trying to get you to do or to keep you from doing is sort of irrelevant. And so you see in the life of Jesus do things that Now, some people won't like this, Chad, but Jesus does things that, by the letter of the law, are unlawful. But as the one who wrote the law, he knows have nothing to do with what the law is trying to communicate. So this one, people will try to, oh, well, technically you can do this because of this or that or the other thing. But by the letter of the law, like the way that they had it, he's not really supposed to be doing this. He's walking probably further than he's supposed to walk. He's making food, I guess, by grinding up these heads. Technically, he's making food, not supposed to do that. There's other instances, though. I mean, one of the ones that you just can't wrestle out of in any way, shape, or form is Jesus all the time makes himself unclean. I mean, he touches lepers like it's no big deal.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, he literally touches that which is unclean on purpose.
Yeah, and you do that. And if you do that, there's a whole process that you have to go through. Jesus never goes through this process.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he doesn't is because Jesus is like, yo, just check it out. I don't get leprosy. I just don't. Like, because I choose not to get leprosy, so therefore I don't get it. I'm going to go absorb leprosy later on, but I'm not going to get leprosy by touching these guys. In fact, I'm going to heal them. And so this is a story that Jesus uses to show, and what you have to take from it is that even though David is sowing what they used to call it, I don't know if you've heard this before, Chad, this is kind of a Southern thing. Sowing a yarn here. This is a big. No, yarn.
I have heard that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a big. This is what they call a whopper, right? Like, this is quite the story. Like this fish is a little bit bigger than what David actually caught, even though he's doing that. Even though technically he's not supposed to have this bread, Jesus does seem to imply that when the Pharisees interrogate him, that David isn't actually breaking any laws here,
mm-hmm.
that he's not breaking anything that the law was given to prevent you from doing. He's not actually engaged in any of that.
Yeah. And I wonder too, just kind of looking at that particular narrative from First Samuel in the broader context of David's story too, if maybe part of what's going on here is it's almost an elevation of David to a higher level still too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've talked about Saul offering sacrifices, which again was technically not supposed to happen. Now David is getting something from the priest that he technically is not supposed to have. And then later, of course, he will be highly involved in all sorts of priestly kind of matters, everything from gathering all sorts of materials to be used for the construction of the temple. He moves the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. All these kind of priestly type things. And if almost subtly in this story is an indication of, I wouldn't say that David's a priest, but that David is priestly to an extent.
Yeah, well, it's almost like Jesus is using this and saying, you know, David, he's a little bit different than other guys. He's not exactly like everybody else. And you know this. Well, you understand this. Well, guess what? I'm not exactly like everyone else, right? Like David, but even more so, like I'm a little bit different than everyone else, right? It so happens that, you know, in this case, I'm God. I don't need instruction in the law. I know what it means.
And, yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Maybe it's subtle both in the Old and New Testament, but the indication is there's something very priestly about David, and by implication, there's something very priestly about Christ as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those stories in the Gospels where you don't see this often, but it's one of those stories in the Gospels where the priestly character of Jesus is strongly hinted at.
Yeah, well, I think that people kind of assume that the Pharisees and the religious leaders don't actually believe that Jesus is a sinner. They're trying to figure out a way to make him appear like a sinner. I don't think that's exactly right. I think that they very much think he's a sinner. They think he's a heretic, first of all, and that they do actually believe that these things are the things that they can say, aha. Now, they think he's clever. They think he's they think he's pretty smart. They think he can wiggle his way out of stuff. They know that, man, if you get in a dialogue with this guy, you better be ready to go. Like, he's quick, right? But I don't think that they believe, like, oh, this guy is actually sinless walking around, so we're going to have to manufacture some sin. Of course, they do eventually bring people out to give false testimony. But even that is they're bringing out these people to give false testimony because I do believe that they actually believe that this person is not just a sinner, but incredibly dangerous, a lawbreaker extraordinaire. I mean, they don't think that Jesus has any regard for the law.
Yeah, I think they're sincere in that respect. They sincerely believe that he is, as you say, a heretic, that he is a sinner, that he's extremely dangerous to basically everything that they stand for. Mm-hmm. I mean, so yeah, they do engage in some very disingenuous acts, such as, you know, bringing false witnesses and those sorts of things. But at the same time, there is a sincerity in their belief that he is in fact a sinner and is dangerous to the people of Israel. So anyway, that's the New Testament connection there, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's an interesting story that Jesus chose to bring up. I mean, it was fitting, of course.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that he chose that particular example was also strongly suggestive of the fact that he is the new Son of David, that he, as he says in Matthew, that he is Lord of the Sabbath. So someone definitely greater than David was there. David did this. Well, I'm going to do something even more extraordinary in my ministry.
Yeah.
Okay. So we go from the, I don't know what we're going. I was going to say from the sublime to the strange, the awkward, the weird. But that's what we're moving into next. This is another David scenario. This is verses 10 through 15.
Yeah, he chooses an interesting place to go to with a Goliath sword.
I was thinking that just this morning when I was going through here. I mean, he marches into the Philistine city of Gath. That's Goliath's hometown.
Yeah.
Carrying Goliath's sword. I mean, that's... You certainly can never say of David, he's a coward.
No.
He's quite the opposite of that. Yeah, he leaves there, and he goes. He fled that day from Saul, and he goes to Achish or Achish, however you want to say his name. I guess in English we'd say Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, "Isn't this David, the king of the land?" Now that's fascinating. So they referred to David as the king of the land. So this is a case where the Gentiles have it actually more correct than most of the Israelites do. They know about David's prowess in battle. They know about his fame, or from their perspective, infamy. And so they say, well, this guy's, you know, he's the king. I know we talk about Saul, but hey, you know, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has tens of thousands.
Yeah, this is
exactly what they quote next.
Yeah, this is what I'm going to say. Like, this is they're sort of ascribe this kingness to David, and it seems that it's partially based on this like song that they've heard being sung, which is Saul has struck down his thousands and David his tens of thousands. They're like, well, obviously, David's
He's
the man.
He's got to be king.
that's yeah. The guy.
Yeah,
and who are they always engaging with? I mean, it is not Saul that's going out there and kicking their butt on the week to week basis. No, it's David. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. So they're like, they're not that worried about Saul, but David is. I mean, you got to remember, David has killed a lot of Philistines at this, not just Goliath. I mean, he got killed 200 of them and took their foreskins off. I mean, they know who this guy is, which is. Adds to the craziness of David just marching there all by himself.
Yeah, I do not get this. I guess he thought that he could somehow slip in and no one would know who he was. Well, it didn't work. So they quote the song. David hears about this. This is, he took these words to heart and greatly feared the king. Well, yeah, he should. So what does he do? Well, he didn't just run away. He didn't try and hide. He didn't stand up and present some sort of eloquent defense of himself or come up with some other, you know, yarn like he did earlier. he engages in one of what I think is one of the most crazy and humorous acts of deceit that we have in the entirety of the scriptures. He acts like he's insane. He disguised his sanity before them, acted insanely in their hands. And here's how he did it. It said he was scribbling on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down into his beard. So David is being quite the actor here. I mean, he's going all out. This guy was, you know, should have been in theater.
There's two things about this. This tells me two things. One, that as much as David is going to be afraid of this king, apparently he's less afraid of this king than he is of Saul. Like, so he's like, maybe I have a shot at not being killed by this guy. I have no shot at not being killed by Saul. Saul's going to kill me.
Yeah.
So that really tells you how horrible Saul's behavior is. Two, that all these pictures of David with no beard are just wrong. Right? So, like, I mean, every
I've not thought of that.
Every picture you see of David, every drawing, every painting, every statue, this dude's got no beard. But apparently, he's got a beard that spit can run down. So
yeah, apparently he does. Yeah, like basically every Israelite back then.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, like, let's just remove the beardless David. Maybe when he went out there against Goliath when he was younger, maybe he didn't have a beard going on. But by this time, apparently he's got a beard.
He does. Yeah. Good point. So he's acting the part. He's doing good. In fact, David did so well that he actually made the Philistines believe. So it says he said to the servants, or the king said to his servants, "Look, this guy is acting like a madman. Why did you bring him to me?" And then, I love the last verse. He's like, "Do I lack madmen that you have brought one more? This brought this madman into my presence. Shall this one come into my house?" So the king is like, look, guys, we got enough madmen around here already. I don't know why you're bringing me one more. We've surpassed our quota. So I don't need another madman. Get this guy out of here."
this is like a great response, right? Okay. I mean, do I have a deficiency of crazy people in my life? Is that why you brought this guy? No, I do not. So get this guy out of here.
Get this guy out of here. Yeah.
It gives you a little glimpse into this king's personality, right?
It does. It does. Yeah. He's kind of a funny guy. Anyway, well, the ruse works. David gets out of there. He's fine. And then what I find this whole account, even though it's just a few verses, I just find fascinating. There are two Psalms, Psalm 34 and Psalm 56, that arose out of this incident. So evidently it made such an impression on David that he decided that he would not just write one song. He would write two songs about this. So if you look at the heading of Psalm 34 and the heading of Psalm 56, both of them indicate that this particular incident was that which prompted David to write the words of those psalms. By the way, if you look, you'll notice that the king referred to at the heading of those psalms is Abimelech and not Achish that we have here. Abimelech is a title. We have Abimelech as the title of Philistine kings all the way back in Genesis 20 and 26. So evidently it just was like a throne name, if you will. Abimelech means "my father is king." So don't think there's a contradiction there. Abimelech, just a throne name for Achish. But anyway, check out those Psalms 34 and 56 and see how David responds to this particular situation. I like to say Psalm 34 is an acrostic, so an ABC, an alphabet psalm. So extremely organized, you know, everything is laid out with great concern for precision, for organization. And so I like to say that, you know, to contrast those two. So on the one, out of a situation where David pretends to be mad and insane, comes a highly organized, highly structured psalm. So a madman teaches us how to pray. He teaches us that, you know, there's a benefit to having psalms like Psalm 34 we have. An organized, very clearly laid out psalm that gives some structure in an otherwise kind of crazy, crazy world.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, all right. Well, that is chapter 21. So we'll be back next week for chapter 22. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right. We'll see you then.